No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shallow Politics, an hour-long grassroots show that will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the conversation by calling in at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype your questions to BBSRADIOPR. We have a special guest tonight, a candidate for the Congress in the 1st Congressional District in Maryland, Allison Galbraith, and we'll bring her on in a second. But first, let me tell you what's going on with statehood. The Puerto Ricans have put in a statehood bill. Their resident commissioner, Jennifer Gonzalez Colon, put in legislation last week into the House. They have 10 Republican co-sponsors.
And, really?
Yeah, and two Democrats.
Really?
So this week, we've planned meetings with two of the Republican co-sponsors to see if we can get them to be co-sponsors on our bill. They would be the first two Republicans on our bill. But we have great hopes. One of them is actually Commissioner Gonzalez Colon, and the other one's a congressman from Alaska. But we're going to talk to them, hope we can get them on our bill, and maybe we can start the ball rolling for both of us. So that's the big news in statehood this week. But our guest tonight is a woman who ran for Congress in Maryland's 1st Congressional District. She was running in the Democratic primary. She did very, very well, but came in second. She's an amazing young woman. Some of my staff went down there to help her and said that she just ran a great campaign. And the reason we went to help her is because, unfortunately, the Republican incumbent, Andy Harris, is a guy that interferes in the District of Columbia all the time, and we don't like that. And so we're angry about it, and we're going to start saying to members of Congress, if you mess with the District of Columbia, the District of Columbia is going to mess with you.
And so, what do you mean by messes with the D.C.?
Well,
what kind of examples?
As listeners know, Congress has legislative authority in all cases whatsoever in the District of Columbia, and Andy is one of the people that exercises it from time to time. He's interfered with our everything from needle exchange to legalization of marijuana to health benefits for poor women in the District of Columbia. He messes with our budget. He tried to get our death with dignity law overturned last year. He's just constantly meddling in District of Columbia, and we want to say to him, look, the people of Maryland deserve to be represented, and so represent them and worry about let the people of District of Columbia and the people they elect worry about representing them. So
now, is he more active than most with all of
he's one of the most active.
And what do you suppose is driving that behavior?
That he can do that. I mean, that's my opinion, is that, that he can, and you can, very often these guys that do this or these people that do this want to court favor with particular constituencies like the National Rifle Association. If you're from Alabama or Texas, you have pretty liberal gun laws. So if you want to make points with the NRA, you attack the gun laws in Washington, D.C., because they're tough gun laws.
Mm-hmm.
this is not Andy Harris's MO, though. He seems to attack everything he doesn't like that's not a conservative policy. And, you know, that's tough because the district's a very liberal jurisdiction. So I assume he does it to gain points, but I don't know. Let's ask Allison. Allison, are you there? Allison, are you with us?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Yeah, I can hear you fine. So why do you think Andy Harris likes to mess with the District of Columbia?
He's an ideologue.
Yeah.
And it might come down to donors. I'm not sure. He just seems to like to assert himself randomly. But he's got some really sort of radical ideas that I certainly can't wrap my head around, but he made me angry enough to run against him.
And what do you mean by radical, Allison?
It's just across the board. It's across the board. It's inconsistency and hypocrisy. Like, for instance, how I started running. He's a doctor, right? He had come up through the Maryland State Legislature, and then he was elected to the House of Representatives here in District 1. And after the 2016 election, I went in as a constituent to go see him. My background is in public policy. I'm not really about partisan ideology. It's either a good idea or it's a bad idea, and your party has nothing to do with it. But I went into his office, and I explained that I started a business back in 2014, and I did it because my mother had had a bunch of strokes, and I'd been laid off. I mean, caregivers don't have a lot of protection. And then I got separated from my ex-husband and then divorced, and I lost access to his health insurance policy. And the only reason I could buy a policy is because the ACA said that you couldn't charge women more than men for the same policy anymore. And also that you couldn't deny based on pre-existing conditions, which for me were simply pregnancy-related and nothing else. And I knew this because I'd had an experience where I couldn't buy health insurance and was going to go in the high-risk pool at 26 because I had a kid and a complicated pregnancy and for no other reason. And it takes me 4 months to meet the guy, and I finally go in there and I say, look, you know, keep the essential health benefits. These are really important consumer protections to people. And I asked him if he would vote against any legislation which allowed for gender rate hikes. And he actually said to me, in front of other people as well, and my 10-year-old son, that he didn't think most people would mind if women paid a little more for health insurance.
Yeah,
and that's
well,
just one example of the type of things that he does.
Yeah, nobody would mind that except women, probably. You know? I mean, I could see where they would have a problem.
Men who love them.
Yeah, and his constant meddling in the district is what bothers us. But I got to tell you, Allison, first of all, I read your bio, and I just couldn't believe all the things that we have in common. You graduated from a community college. So did I. Your father was a professor at a community college. My brother just retired as president of a community college. We both went to the University of Maryland. We both studied public policy. Your mother, I understand, is involved with Morgan State and university in, or college, and so am I through the Thurgood Marshall Foundation. And you like to do home improvement, which is what I do too, but I suck at it. I mean, it all. What
you're
happens,
good at delegating.
Yeah. What happens is that I fix something, and then we finally like call the plumber or the electrician, who says, "Well, it would have been a lot cheaper, but now we have to undo the work that Mr. Brown did before we can proceed, so it's going to be more expensive." But we have so much in common; it just shocked me. I'm a big fan.
Oh, thank
Allison,
you.
I'm curious, how did you find the election process and the campaign? What was that like for you? Can you go back to when you pulled papers and then moving forward?
I had nothing to base it on. I didn't have, I paid attention to politics. I certainly paid attention to the social issues and economic issues, especially with regard to the federal government, because I work in acquisition. But I had no idea really what I was getting into. I guess I thought that it was a dirty, disgusting process, and now I'm even more cynical that it is, in fact, a dirty, disgusting process. You know, and I think that I had a lot of barriers, too, being a single mom and middle class and you know, not having, like, a personal bank account that I could leverage for it or a lot of connections or anything like that. I just jumped in there because I wasn't going to deal with my congressman trying to tank me.
So that was what I hear is the most difficult part is the fundraising part. The
asking it is.
For dollars.
It is.
And that's monumental.
One of the things, you know, maybe this is the failure of the campaign, but it's also something I'm proud of. I didn't have anybody maxed out. Not a single one. I just had thousands and thousands of small donors. And I believe that that's what it should be. You know, because right now you have a system which rewards privilege, which means that, and people fight for the problems that they know. So if what we have is a Congress full of very privileged individuals and they don't live the same problems that the working class and middle class families are living, then they're disinclined, or less inclined at least, to actually address those problems because it's not their problem.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's just leading to entire classes of people being left behind. And I don't even mean that just by, you know, it's not even a partisan thing. I think it's Congress. Both parties are doing it.
Well, and you know what? I don't think that people really realize that. And I've got to tell you, I think you're making such an important point here, Allison, because this is how I got involved in politics. I got involved in politics coming out of college. I went to work for Jimmy Carter. And there I was. I found myself surrounded by people who were not like me. I found myself surrounded by people that had trust funds and had gone to Ivy League colleges and really were at the top of society, where I was a kid from a working class family. I was an orphan. I worked my way through college and graduate school, et cetera, et cetera. And I said to myself, I have an important voice that needs to be part of the conversation because there aren't a lot of people like me here. And I don't think people understand how important that is to have you represented at the table, or you don't get what you deserve. And I think a lot of people don't understand that about politics.
But along those lines, Allison, because I was a single mother when my children were 2, 4, 6, and 8 when their dad and I divorced. And when you are trying to keep a family together, a roof over their head, and a career going, who has the luxury of time to run for office?
Well, nobody. I just had to make it because nothing anybody threw at me was going to be worse than taking away the one thing that allowed me to have the business, which gave me the flexibility to help care for my mom. I only have one child. You must have had your hands full, but I'm in the sandwich generation. So both my parents got sick. And then I think my snapping point was that about 3 days after I had that conversation with Andy Harris, my mother passed away. And she's a woman who spent her entire life advocating for health insurance or health care, universal health care. It just seems so fundamentally wrong to me that the only reason I could take care of her is because ACA helped me. And here's my doctor congressman who went to the same, you know, my mom had a PhD in public health from Hopkins. He also went to Hopkins, you know, he would take all that away. Just because he didn't want to listen to somebody about basic consumer protection.
Right. And, you know, again, Allison, I ran a small business for 25 years, and my wife is on the career path that she's on these days. She's a school librarian because when she was a stay-at-home mom and health insurance got so expensive for me, so expensive, it was almost twice what my mortgage payment was, that she was offered a job in a library and took it because it came with health insurance. And it was a part-time job, and they didn't pay her very much, but they gave her health insurance, and that was important to us. It was the only thing that allowed us to survive and be in business you know, and me being business for myself. And ultimately that led her to a master's degree in library science, and she became a full-time librarian. But, you know, that was the motivation for us too, is we just couldn't afford the health insurance anymore.
Well, I think, sorry, go on.
It's okay, Allison. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Oh, well, to your point, you know, about the time, my business is always set up for flexibility because of caregiver obligations.
Mm-hmm.
So when she passed away, I had a flexible business. So the whole campaign, except for the month of June, I was working at least probably 30 hours a week in my normal business, and then also running this congressional campaign. But I did. You know, I took a totally different approach to my campaign than strategists or you know, traditional campaign managers would tell you to approach it. I was very heavy in social media. I used the activist groups. I used all small dollar fundraising. A lot of it was done online. I mean, I traveled through the district a lot, and my son came with me. But, you know, I was still able – I didn't beat myself up about it if I thought, hey, I'm going to be home with my son 2 or 3 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm just not sacrificing these certain things.
Mm-hmm.
And did you have debates and encounters for the...
They had a bunch of forums between all of the candidates. At first, it was just me for a long time. And then a couple months later, another progressive jumped in. And then we got a bunch of candidates flooding in after that. And it ended up being the most competitive primary that we've had in this district for a long time. And, you know, I do like to think that if I hadn't just jumped out there, because I got in really early, like February or March or April 2017. I think if I hadn't jumped out there and just started going after Harris every single day in a public forum, I don't know that it ever would have gotten that competitive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because the party said, oh, well, that district's too hard. Why don't you run for a seat you can win? And I said, he said, I'm not giving them a free pass. I'm not going to have people think that their voice doesn't matter if the party doesn't want to come here, and we'll do it ourselves.
Yeah, that's always a tough choice. But I agree with you that you should run for the office where you want to make a difference, not necessarily for the office you think you have the best shot at. And I think you ran a very good campaign. You came in second among six candidates, right?
Yes, and out of the actual competitive ones, I raised a little over 100,000.
Wow, that's great.
But I work in streamlining for a living, so I use totally, you know, and I'm like the do-it-yourself queen, like with the home improvement projects and all that. And my campaign was no different. It was like a volunteer army behind me, and my people were great. And our return on investment per dollar spent was significantly higher. And, it took 6 rounds of mailers and TV ads and every endorsement you can imagine to beat me. So... And I was just using grassroots while working, you know.
So tell me about the top vote getter. Is that the difference, do you think, between your campaign and theirs, that they had more resources?
So I used to joke with him. I said, I'll be curious to see which one of us wins because we run totally opposite strategies. I always knew that I couldn't stomach the big donor call, you know. And in that sense, maybe politics is not for me, not in this current environment. But so I didn't do it. I was like, I'm a single mom. I run a business. How am I going to make calls and beg for money 8 hours a day? I wouldn't do it. He was the big money candidate. So, yeah, he came in and towards the end, I heard rumor that there was some polling that had us neck and neck. And then 6 rounds of mailers and TV ads came out. And I still won 3 counties. But there were 3 counties over on the Eastern Shore where there was just a big gap because of the other progressive, and I had sort of seeded them, and they came in through there and won those counties and got the nomination. I mean, I think it was I'm happy that I got as far as I did because I completely tossed the rules for political campaigns out the window and said, I'm going to do what I can because I'm a single mom and I don't have the luxury of quitting my job to run.
Well, you know what? I think, first of all, I would disagree with you here, Allison. I think this is the perfect place for you to be. And I hope you continue to involve yourself in politics. I know that you're going to help the person that won. I know you're teaming, you know, you're supporting him, but I hope you stay and I hope you continue to run for public office because things are changing. You know, things are changing. I was a direct mail consultant for many years in politics. I've worked on many presidential campaigns and national campaigns, and the internet is changing everything. So you reaching out through social media, you using small donors to fuel your campaign, those are all positive things, and those are all things of the future, and those are things that are just going to get better. So I hope you stay in there, you hang in there, because I think as a single mom, you have an important voice, and it's a voice that needs to be heard. Let me ask you a question.
Wait, let me piggyback on that, Michael, because it's common knowledge. I've attended campaign management school, and I've been the campaign manager for candidates more on the local level, like mayor and city council, whatnot. But Allison, the fact that you came in second means that you have name recognition, and that therefore means that there are other opportunities that the party should be interested in supporting you for, because you've established that you know how to get it done. And they often wait to see who comes in second, because the first, it, apparently you can buy it a little bit with the last minute mail and the TV ads and stuff. But the one that came through like you did and with grassroots and with your credentials, there's no reason that you shouldn't be considering other offices at all.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Maria. And one thing I want to ask you, because I'm the same way you are. I run everything. You know, I run a small campaign. I run, you know, we made our own yard signs, for God's sakes, you know, things like that. But I run in a district that's 10 miles square. I see the first district of Maryland, and it's gigantic. How do you, you can't do a door-to-door campaign in a congressional district like that, can you?
Well, I mean, we had a bunch of, so Hartford County, where I'm from, that's like the most populated part of the district is my backyard, which was definitely a benefit. And I grew up here, and there are a number of Galbraith families in the county, and my dad taught at the community college. There are tens of thousands of people had my father teaching them English and Spanish over the years. But and that certainly helped in Hartford County. But we knocked a ton of doors. And we would have teams set up in different counties. So we had a team for Baltimore County. We had a team for Hartford County. We had a team in Wicomico County. And, you know, I think that if we had had teams set up through Talbot, Queen Anne's, and Kent, where the other candidates outperformed me pretty significantly, I think we would have given them a serious run for their money if we had had better ground game in those areas. And I think it can be done that way. And I think it means something, because I always went after disenfranchised voters. I always understood I'm not your traditional candidate. You know, I myself was a disenfranchised voter for a long time. So I wanted to bring those people back in, the people who felt like government wasn't working for them and that they deserved a voice. I treat you the same if you're a millionaire or if you're penniless.
Well, you know, that's a great segue to what I really want to talk about today, and that is that in the District of Columbia, I just won the Democratic primary in the District of Columbia. In one of our wards, the city's divided into eight wards, only 8% of the population voted. 8% of the registered voter. 92% of the registered voters in Ward 8 didn't show up, and that's registered voters.
Is there a demographic that ward has? Is it older, younger?
Well, it's
younger?
It's the poorest ward in the district.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, it's absolutely the poorest ward, and that's how it seemed to go economically. But even the city overall, even the entire city, only about 18% of the registered voters voted which means that 82% of voters in the District of Columbia who are registered throughout the city did not vote. 82%. This is the nation's capital.
That's
this is
apathetic.
What we do. That, yeah, it's unbelievable.
I mean, that's disgraceful.
And so we're seeing now District of Columbia voters may be the ultimate disenfranchised voters. And there was an article of an op-ed in the paper today that said that's one of the reasons that they don't vote. This guy speculated because we don't have a voice in, excuse me, in Congress. But it's got to be more than that. And I mean, obviously, there's a disconnect out there. So what are you hearing, Allison? What are people saying to you? Why are people telling you they don't vote?
Because, well, so District 1, to give you a little background, District 1 was gerrymandered away and then basically abandoned by the Democratic Party. And they just assumed, okay, well, it's plus 14 Republican and, you know, Harris is going to win. It's not even worth competing there, right? And that was the sentiment. And then, you know, what happened over time, when I was a kid, our electeds were Democrats. You know, same area. But over time, as the party figured out, oh, well, we can just go to these big city areas and the urban areas and we can win with a handful of counties, they stopped sending resources into these districts lost causes, right? So then down ballot races were not being run. And, you know, it's difficult even for any candidate to get the party to support out here because we're just seen as like hopelessly red or something like that. And it's changing now, but that's what it was for a long time. The other thing, so part of it is people feeling like Democrats don't even have a chance here. So what's the point? The other part of it is when it gets to the general election, I think a lot of people feel like, you know, my choices are guy who doesn't understand my problems and guy who doesn't understand my problems. So what's the point? I think there's a lot of that going on. We're very disenfranchised and it's very anti-establishment in District 1 in particular. They're very skeptical of government, let's say.
Well, you know, we try to impress upon people that you not only vote for yourself, but you vote for everybody that's like you. So if you're a woman and you cast a vote, you vote for all women. Because when politicians sit down and they look at the statistics of who votes and who doesn't, that decides in their minds who gets the attention and who doesn't. And if you don't vote, if one of the reasons that they don't cut Social Security, but they cut education at the drop of a hat, is that young people don't vote and old people do vote. So we try to impress that upon people. It's not just voting for yourself, but it's voting for everybody that's like you, everybody in your area, everybody of your sex and religion and economic status, because that's what politicians respond to. That's how we feed them, right, with our votes. So
but get this,
it's
though,
such
Michael,
an important thing. Yeah.
With such low turnout, you're giving power to few so that our elected officials don't represent the majority because they're elected by the minority. So well, in your case with the District of Columbia and that ward with 8%, that means that those others didn't get heard from or spoken about or cared for because they didn't bother to turn out.
Well, let me give you the perfect example of that, which is I just can't even believe they're considering doing this. But there was a referendum on the ballot to increase the minimum wage for wage employees, servers basically in restaurants. Most servers were against it, but it passed. It passed. Only 10% of the registered voters in the District of Columbia voted for it, but that was enough to get it to pass because voter turnout was so low. Now, the city council, there are members of the city council thinking of overturning the referendum that they put on the ballot because the voters didn't make the right choice as far as they were concerned, and only 10% of them voted. First of all, I can't believe that you could put a referendum on the ballot and then overturn it, because, you know, I mean, what's
Sounds like a monarchy, right?
Yeah, it sounds like a monarchy, right. We didn't like what you did,
so we're changing it.
You know, but the point is, yeah, only 10% of the people of the District of Columbia voted for that. And it's, you know, and it's exactly what you're saying. A handful of people are making all the decisions.
Yes.
So what did you do, Allison, to convince people that they should vote, that they should reengage, that they should vote for you? What did you tell them?
My message is always a little different depending on what people care about, but a lot of the time it was just about people and perspective mattering, that all of our voices matter, that, you know, you need to turn out and you need to vote. But I would ask this, right? Because we had problems in the areas that we didn't have a significant presence. And one of the things that I felt when I was younger, the first time I ever had anybody show up at my door, I'm 35. So the first time that I ever had anybody show up at my door, it was the Bernie Sanders people.
Wow.
And nobody else had ever shown up at my door. I think we need to ask ourselves why we expect people to turn out and vote for a party or people that have turned their back on us. I think that our strategies are wrong. Just across the board, you know, I get why people go after super voters and target only super voters from a resource standpoint, right? But democracy long term it's not sustainable to do that. You have to get these people involved, which means that you might need to go talk to them. You might need to give them a little, you know, pay a little attention to them. Ask them, like, you may need to personally ask somebody, will you go out and vote? And a lot of the times it's not getting done. The areas where we did go out and ask people, yeah, we still got some pushback, and it was always a risky strategy. But a lot of people that never voted in midterms, I had people who said, listen, I'm in my 70s. I'm a grandmother. I'm a grandfather. I was a registered Republican up until this year. I've never once in my life voted in a midterm election, much less a primary. And I flip my political party to Democrat to go vote for you in the primary because you showed that you cared.
Yeah.
If you talk to people, if you show them, like, look, this isn't the same old game. I'm a different candidate. But you do need that personal touch. I mean, you have to talk to people or they simply won't turn out. They don't know that it matters. And most people are more worried about whether they have bologna in their fridge for their kids' lunch tomorrow than they are about a Democratic primary on like one of the hottest weeks in the summer.
Well, you know, I think you've absolutely hit the nail on the head. And I think this is a problem with the Democratic Party. You know, in the last election, we had our candidate going to places where Democrats have never won, places like Utah at the last minute, instead of going to places where Democrats feel disenfranchised, like Wisconsin. You know, we lost states that, as you described, Maryland being solidly Democratic at one time. Many of the places that we lost in the last election were solidly Democratic at one time. And I think that one thing is we don't reach out enough as Democrats to people. How do you feel about that?
I think the Democratic Party abandoned rural areas, and that I think it's totally understandable, maybe not right, but I see why they do it, for people to say, why should I not turn my back on a party that turned its back on us?
Oh, absolutely.
I think that's the thing people need to get.
How do you put into perspective Ocasio-Cortez's victory in New York? Because you share similarities, being young and first time and Democrat and challenging the status quo. And she somehow ignited passion and obviously got people to turn out with her liberal politics, no less, too, in a liberal state. I'm curious, was there better voter turnout? I haven't seen numbers about that. I've been trying to drill down and I can't find anything. I don't know if either of you can speak to that, but I mean, I thought she gave a lot of people hope.
I don't know about the turnout, but that is a blue district. And I would think that it would be a little easier to rally support in a blue district.
But she was running against a Democrat. So
what?
She was running against a Democrat.
Right, right. So I think she was part of Brand New Congress, maybe, and they were going after incumbents of the same party. I think their sort of mission. And I think that helped, but she also played a large role in our revolution. She had a populist message. It was that, and I don't mean populist as a dirty word. I mean populist as in for the people. And people who feel left behind by government, there are a lot of people that are awake now that were not paying attention before, that were not voting before, that were not involved before. And when you get a strong ground game going, or these postcards to voters, or, I mean, there are all kinds of ways that you can use digital media and grassroots tactics. And I'm guessing she was using that, and she had a strong message, and her video went viral. Her video was amazing. I mean, I got it. I got why people voted for her, because it was about the little guy. And that's what government really ought to be. It ought to be about the little guy. But our system itself weeds out people who have, less means.
Well, you know, I think, yes, and I think that one of the answers to your question, Maria, is exactly what Allison's talking about. You know, people are tired of the status quo, and, you know, there was no more clear example of the status quo than the person that she ran against, who was a long-term incumbent in the Democratic Party and also a pretty powerful guy in Congress. And also the other comment you made, Allison, about people being forgotten and feeling, why should I go out for a party that doesn't go out for me? That's exactly why I became a Democrat. I became a Democrat because I woke up one day and I said, I am a Democrat. You know, I'm a former Teamster. I was a Teamster when I was 17 years old. I'm a working class kid that worked his way up from the bottom. That's who the Democratic Party was when I became a Democrat. I don't know that Democratic Party is that anymore, unfortunately, in a lot of cases. But that's who it was when I first registered to vote. And that's why I registered to vote. And I think you're absolutely right that people want to vote for people they think have their interests at heart. And if you look like you don't have their interests at heart, they don't want to vote for you. And unfortunately, the Democrats, I think, in a lot of cases, we've forgotten who we were. And that's a problem.
So, Allison, can you tell me about your campaign? What was like the highlight for you? What made it worth your efforts and the time?
I think the highlight of the entire thing, or one of those just whoa, like speechless moments. I park my car in Cambridge, which is one of the historic towns, little, not high income. And this woman, about 30-ish, knocks on my glass, and she's pointing at the signs in the back of my car, and she says, I want one of those. And I said, okay. You know, and I reached back to get this sign and hand it to her, and she says, you know, I wasn't registered as a Democrat. I don't vote. I hate politics. I feel like none of these guys care about me, and so I just haven't been involved. But her, I registered as a Democrat. I'm going to go out and I'm going to vote in this primary for her, because I don't want her to just be my representative. I want Allison Galbraith to be my president one day.
And there you go.
It hit me. She has no idea that she's talking to me.
To you, right.
I think
what a beautiful moment that is.
Hair. Yeah, but anyway, it was like, it's like, wow, these people who feel left behind by government, they do believe in me. They are coming out. And lo and behold, that woman was out there on the first day of early voting, 15 minutes before the doors even opened, so that she could go in there and be one of the first people to go in and cast a vote. You know, we got new people engaged in the political process. And I know where these people are, a lot of them. And we can keep them engaged. And we can show them that government does work for them. And we can make sure that they go out and they vote in these midterms and that their voice matters. And those people will talk to their friends. And they'll get their friends to go vote. She got her friends to go out. I met some of them. And it's just, like, that made a difference. Me getting
Please
in there
tell
and
me
saying,
you
I'm
let her know
wait.
That that was you. Right, Allison?
I did.
Okay,
I did.
Good.
I
you
like,
have to make her day.
when I managed to close my jaw, I said, that's me.
Well, you know, I've told this story before on the air. I had just the opposite experience. Of course, I've had some great experiences just like that, and they really do make it all worthwhile. But I had an experience one time where I handed a piece of literature to this lovely elderly woman who looked at it and said, Michael Brown, I hate that guy. And I looked at her and I said, no, I thought she was confused about who it was. And I said, no, that's me. And she looked at me and she said, I know who you are, and handed it back to me. So I said, not much to say it at that point. But I have to tell Maria this. One of the people that Allison ran against was a guy named Michael Brown.
Oh.
Yeah.
So that's where your middle initial.
You don't know who he is?
He just appeared on the ballot.
He just appeared on the ballot. I met him once for 30 minutes. He left the forum early.
Yeah,
wow.
I don't know anything about him either, but there are many of us in the world. So, Allison, what's the thing that surprised you most? The thing that surprised me most the first and second and third time I ran was the press. I was surprised by the press. Tell me what surprised you the most about running.
What surprised me? Well, Kim, the woman in Cambridge, she certainly surprised me. Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you, just to give you an example, what I was surprised by. I didn't expect the press to be particularly biased or particularly. I thought that they would be very, you know, very neutral and would report honestly and openly and. The first time I found out that they don't necessarily do that really surprised me.
I think I went into it with a pretty cynical attitude. I was surprised at some of the union endorsements because I'd actually been a union member.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and how complicated and the processes are for endorsement. Like, I still couldn't tell you what they are. For AFL-CIO, I have no idea.
Yeah. Well, I was the same way. I've been endorsed by unions, and I've had my opponents endorsed by unions. And you know, and I was the same way. I was a Teamster, and I felt that you know, the first time I went in for the endorsement, I said to the Teamsters Union, I said, look, I'm a former Teamster. I was a member of this local. I showed them all my printing material and said, I use a union printer to do everything I do. And some guy stood up from the leadership and he said, what have you done for you? But what have you done for unions in the last year? And I said, well, I've given over $1 million to local union vendors because I only use union vendors, and I've given them to local mail shops and print shops and all sorts of other vendors. And this guy stood there and applauded for me. He stood there and he said, oh my God. Yeah. Whoa. And then they endorsed my opponent who said I was a teacher once. And I think they were a union. That was her explanation. I went on for 20 minutes on what
oh
I did
my
for
gosh.
Me. And she said, I was a teacher once, and I think I was a member of a union. And they endorsed her. And I was blown away by that. I just didn't get it. But I understood later, because she was the incumbent, they thought she was going to win. And that was more important to them, really, than who I was or what I stood for. And that was unfortunate. But
see, that's the part that you, Allison, called dirty. that just like Michael, that you had gotten council members to agree to something and then they didn't follow up with their word to you. I mean, I know the human condition is such that we do that to one another, but when you do it publicly and you're in an elected office, you would think that there would be more integrity and ethics involved, or is that not possible?
Yeah, you hope. That's exactly right. Yeah. And I think a lot of people are corrupted by the process. I think that they go in with the best intentions. But, you know, I have often said, if you want to make Congress less susceptible to corruption, the first thing I would do would be to give every congressman a 4-year term. I think the fact that they're constantly have to pander to people to get reelected works against them and works against people. I think that, you know, 2 years is just a ridiculously amount
turnaround. Absolutely.
Yeah, it really is, because they get finished with one campaign, it's almost time to start another.
That is true. Well, yeah. And Allison, you got in almost a year and a half in advance, case in point.
Yeah.
Right.
I have a friend who's elected in the county, and he announced that he wasn't going to seek re-election in June. And he said to me, and one of the best parts of that is I don't have to pretend to like people anymore that I don't really like.
Yeah.
It's liberating. I will say that part of not being in there, not being the nominee, is it's a relief to me, because I'm nobody would ever say I'm in sort, but you know, you have to have a different filter, and you have to be more patient, and you have to be careful what you say to people and careful what you do and how you act and what you wear. And it's like, you know, we're rewarding the wrong things here. We're worried about the wrong things with our elected officials.
Well, Michael, you just said it as recently as last week. Unlike other positions in life, politics requires that you're likable.
Right. I mean, it's a strange thing that if you were, you know, if you were the most dislikable SOB on the planet, but you ran a good company, you could be president of the company, you know, or you could be quarterback of the football team, or you could be. But there's a personality element in politics, which is really strange, that people have, they really have to like you. They have to, what Allison said it earlier, they have to be able to connect with you somehow. So, and that's why politicians go out there and the most powerful thing they can say is, I'm like you. I'm a mom. I'm a union member. I'm a veteran. I'm a, you know, all those things that help them connect to who you are. I have kids. I know what it feels like. I have a job. I've come up through the ranks, whatever it is. It's an important thing. And, it really hurt the Democrats with Hillary Clinton. There were a lot of people I knew that said to me, you know, I just don't like her. You know, it's not, you know, on paper she looks good and blah, blah, blah. I just don't like her. But let me ask you this question, Allison. What do you think? Mm-hmm. Because I think this may be one of the legacies of the Trump administration. We see so many women that fit your profile, your age range, your particular position in life, getting involved in politics, like this young woman in New York. What do you think about that? You think that this is a new era for women in politics?
I think that Hillary Clinton losing in the long term probably did more for women than her winning would have, if that makes any sense. In that people got angry enough to get up and do something and get involved. And maybe it was anger, maybe it was fear, maybe it was frustration, whatever. But that, you know, it got them moving. Whereas, you know, if Hillary had won, everybody would be like, okay, so this is the progress you were looking for, I guess.
Right.
You know, yeah, and maybe thought that it's okay to stay uninvolved. And I'm glad that there are these grassroots campaigns going on and that we're pulling some of the disenfranchised back in. I'm not real happy about the turnout for primaries.
Right.
But, I mean, I don't know what it is.
What was yours? Do you know?
No, I don't know offhand. I haven't done a scrub of the numbers. I'm like, oh, I'm not running. I'm going to take a break. Like, I'm going to go hang a painting and paint my wall and have a picnic, go out.
It is the most beautiful thing. I mean, and you know, my colleague will be up in 2 years. And that's, you know, and if I win re-election, that'll be the best time for me. I'll get to go out and hug everybody at campaign rallies and not give a damn one way or the other because I'm not running for anything. I mean, it really is a beautiful thing. And I know that you're supporting the person that won the primary. What do you think about his chances against Andy Harris? You got any predictions? You think he'll do well?
Any of us had an uphill battle. It's a hard district. And Harris is using his seat to send out mailers to, not mailers like your traditional mailers, but letters to everybody bragging about, I don't know, pro-life stance and abortion bans and whatever it is that he's doing this week. But, you know, and it, on the face of it, it I'm sure looks like normal business, but he's sending them to people that feel totally opposite, and I suspect he's just trying to get his base riled up with the Supreme Court seat up, and I mean, he has the ability to do that as a sitting congressman. It's not even a campaign activity. It's his office.
Yeah, no, so we have the same things happen in Washington, that people send out these mailers telling you how wonderful they are, using government money to do it, which I think is wrong, but they can do it because they're incumbents. Luckily, I don't have any extra money laying around, so that's not a problem for me. Well, you know, we're running out of time here, and I just think that you've been a great guest, Allison, so thanks so much for being on the show, and I want to give you the opportunity, one, to tell people, in case you have a campaign debt, if they want to contribute to your campaign and help you resolve that debt, how they can do it, what your website is. And I also want to give you the opportunity to say anything that we haven't given you the opportunity to say.
Oh, I do have campaign debt. I have only been able to take maybe a third of my personal reimbursements and all that, like, out-of-pocket costs out of the campaign. And there are a couple of people who definitely deserve a bonus because they did an awful lot of work, and we just don't have anything in there to give them.
That's a website.
It's AllisonForCongress.com, two L's, or you can go to FlipTheFirst.com, and then there's a link to donate. Or I think the direct link is bit.ly/FlipTheFirst.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for being with us, and I hope you'll come back as the campaign progresses and we can talk. I wanted to talk a little more about what we need to do to move forward as Democrats. So maybe next time you come back, we can discuss that a little more. We'll both have a little more perspective being a little further from our campaigns at that point. But thanks again for being on. We hope to talk to you again soon. Remember that web address, folks, and go visit and give a couple of bucks to Allison because she ran a great campaign.
And it was, yes, and I really admire you acting on your ambition and the wanting to make a difference. That's admirable.
Well, thank you. One of the things my mom always taught me is you can't erase your own hardship, but you can try and make sure it doesn't become someone else's too. So if I had a problem to fix for myself, I was going to try and fix it for everybody at the same time instead of just upping my rates and calling it a day.
Good job.
Well, yeah, that's a great way to end things. And tonight we're going to leave you with a song from the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Drama Department. These kids watched their friends and teachers get murdered inside their school, and this is how they responded. And I hope that there's a lesson here for all of us. We'll see you next week.
Thank you for listening. We appreciate the privilege.
Thank you.
In the capital of this nation, 200 years of exploitation, give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right to vote.